Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to 10% Happier early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
From ABC, this is the 10% Happier podcast. I'm Dan Harris. Today we're talking about everybody's favorite subject, death. I don't know why this, well, I know why, but it's odd if you think about it, why this subject freaks everybody out, because it's coming for all of us and everybody we know. And yet, and this is true for me too, it's very difficult to think about death, especially your own. It's a little bit like trying to get a cat to look in the mirror or hold two magnets together. It's just like there's a lot of resistance. People don't want to think about it. And we sort of quarantine our older people into nursing homes, and we paint people up when they're in open caskets, and we just don't want to think about this fundamental reality. And one of the things that I love about Buddhism, and as an aside here, when I talk about Buddhism, I don't think of it as something to believe in, but rather something to do. So what I like about the practice of Buddhism, not the faith of it, is that it forces you, just like after, you know, your dog poops on the rug, it forces you to look at this reality in a rigorous, repetitive way. It forces you to look at the hard fact of impermanence and to consider that it applies to you. And my two guests today have radically reoriented their entire lives to confront this fact. And they are, and they have long titles here, but don't be fooled, they're pretty down to earth, notwithstanding these long titles. Sensei Robert Chodo Campbell and Sensei Koshin Paley Ellison. They are from the New York Zen Center for Contemplative Care. Gentlemen, thanks for being on.
Nice to see you.
It's good to see you.
Okay, so let's just, I have a million questions for you. These guys, they're Zen priests, notwithstanding the fact that they wear black robes. They are anything but funereal, and that's despite the fact that their whole job right now is to do hospice care. So I have a million questions for both of you, but I'm going to start with you, Koshin. Because I want to talk about your respective backstories, how you got to where you are now.
Okay.
You were born with what name?
Daniel.
Daniel.
Yeah.
Daniel Paley Ellison.
Yes.
And so now it's Sensei Koshin Paley Ellison. How did we get from Daniel to a four-name title? And you've got a bunch of little acronyms after your name too, because you've got some
degrees.
Yeah, some degrees.
Yeah.
How did we get there?
Well, that's a good question.
That's what people always say when they don't want to answer the question. That's a good question.
I think one of the ways that we got here is that my...
Keep it in the eye. Talk about you.
All right, then.
I should say these two are not only do they run the New York Zen Center for Contemplative Care together. They do stand-up comedy. They live together, and you've been together for how long as romantic partners? So you're gonna that'll come through. So anyway, yes, keep it in the eye. Even though we're Buddhists here, keep it in the eye.
Well, I think of my great-grandfather was a rabbi and had come over here from escaping pogroms, and he was so dedicated to service. And he was kind of the only, as far as I know, religious or spiritual-based person in our family. And he was so dedicated to housing people coming over from Russia and from Poland and during the war. And I think that in some ways I always had such an affinity to him. And his son, my grandfather, was also totally dedicated to service. And to his life was about service and care for other people. And he was my inspiration as a young person. And the story goes that my mom said that when I was 8, she said, "So when do you want to grow up? What to be when you're an adult?" And I said, "A Zen Buddhist monk."
Really?
Yeah, even before my bar mitzvah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Where did you even get that idea from?
Well, my grandfather, the same grandfather, had shown me. He used to save all the National Geographics for me and look through them with me and say, you know, like, you could explore all of these places. And one of them was one about Tokyo. You know, every once in a while they'd have, like, the lost native tribe of some place, and then they would have some city. and Tokyo, and they had this picture where everyone was blurred and they were in suits and kind of out of focus and in movement. And in the middle of the photo, there was this guy with a hat and with a little smile, and you couldn't see his eyes, and he was wearing robes. And I said, wow, he was so still. And it said below, Zen Buddhist monk in Tokyo. And I said, wow, I'd like to be like that.
Well, we were very different 8-year-olds because I was into like destroying things, bullying people, and trying to kill the squirrels in my backyard. So that would not have appealed to me. Yeah, I was a terrible person. I remain a terrible person. But that's why I'm attracted to you guys, because you could teach me something. Anyway, so eight years old, you were attracted to Zen Buddhism.
There was an early propensity, you could say. Yeah.
But you were a nice Jewish boy growing up here in the New York City area, if I recall correctly?
Upstate New York,
okay. Right. And you went off to college and all that, and was your goal as a young man still to be a Zen Buddhist, or had you moved on to something a little bit more worldly?
Well, I've played with the idea of being a psychologist, but I met my first Zen teacher, John Dido Lurie, when I was 17, and I'd gone out to Naropa University. At that time, it was Naropa Institute, to meet and study with Allen Ginsberg.
Oh, so this is Naropa in Boulder, Colorado. Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And when I went out there to study with Allen, that I saw Dido walking down the street, and he was just like some guy in these robes and so approachable and so warm. And I felt like I'd seen, it was like a deja vu of that picture when I was 8 years old. And I just thought like, but it was like an American guy, somebody like Italian American guy. And he was the first one who really taught me how to sit. And he was so kind and so generous. And
to sit meaning to meditate.
Yeah.
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 And you took to the practice?
Right away.
Yeah. As a young guy. Yeah. And so how did you get to the point where you ordained as a priest and started a hospice care?
Well, that was really through my care of my grandmother. And as I got more and more into my practice, it just became so clear, and what I mean, the meditation practice, that was the most central thing in my life. So ordaining and maintaining the forms seemed like an obvious.
Maintaining the forms?
Yeah, like learning how to like teach people meditation and how to hold a memorial service, how to take care of people through this Zen form, right? And so that felt really central to me. And so that became just kind of an obvious thing. And I felt like that I had burned through, like, my first 10 years of practice, I hated meditating. You know, it was really difficult for me. Like, every time, I couldn't wait for them to ring the bell. Like, they would ring the bell at the beginning, and I would sit there and say, please ring the bell, please ring the bell, please ring the bell.
I've had that experience many times.
But I realized I just kept going back to it. And I think that there was just something about seeing. I saw something that I didn't even know what I was seeing, but there was something that was so powerful about sitting and meditating that I felt that I kept coming back, even though it seemed like every time I hated it. And then suddenly at one retreat, it kind of dropped away, and the resistance to it. And I saw how much I had been kind of not liking my situations one after the other. And I saw through like all those years of meditating and not liking meditating about how I've done that like in so many areas of my life. And it was stopping me from actually fully participating in a way that felt free. And so I like suddenly had this like tiny experience there. Wow, that's what all these teachings are talking about. And
how we get in our own way, basically.
Absolutely. And it was during that whole time that my grandmother was, who was from Brooklyn, and Mimi, and she, you know, got to a certain point in her life where her kids, you know, who loved her so much, my dad and his sister, wanted her to move to an assisted living by them, and she didn't want to do that, and we made a pact together to take care of each other. And so I was living in Brooklyn at the time. And so I would, you know, do shopping with her and taking care of her and, you know, and eventually doing doctor's visits and ambulance rides and hospitalizations, then moving in with her into the hospice unit. And she always had a lot of difficulty with the Zen thing, as she called it. And, you know, as kind of a family, coming from a family of Holocaust survivors, it was really difficult for her, just culturally. It felt like a betrayal. And
a betrayal?
Yeah. Yeah. For her. Mm. And, but it was amazing. But the people who ended up starting to show up around her as she needed more and more care were people from our Zen center. And nobody was talking to her about Zen or meditating with her, but they were just, you know, giving her manicures and pedicures and singing with her or sitting and just, you know, chatting about whatever. And she was extremely interested in using that time to reflect and engage. And, you know, one of the most important moments of my life was one night when she woke me up in the hospice and was apologizing. She was, her tears streaming down her face, and she said that that I'm so sorry that I didn't love you fully. And I didn't love you fully because there was a part of you, that whole Zen thing really scared me. Mm. And but now I see it's so important to you. And actually, all of your friends and Chodo are actually, it's what helps you be with me in a way that nobody else can be with me. Everyone else is so scared. And I'm so sorry. And I realized that now, she's like, I can't believe it took me 87 years to really understand what it means to love someone. And which means to love all of them, not just the parts you want or like. And then, you know, it was amazing. You know, the next day she actually said, you know, you and Chodo should start an organization. And she's like, you know, train people how to care for people, and combining it with that Zen thing. She's like, I never thought I'd say that. And teaching them how to meditate. She's like, those three things, you know, you should start an organization. And so what's so incredible is that it was such a great idea. And so the real founder, in a way, of the New York Zen Center for Contemplative Care is Mimi Ellison, this little Hungarian Jewish lady. So it was her idea.
It's great.
It's so, so great.
And now for something completely different, we're going to talk about Chodo's life experience, which is... Correct me if I'm wrong here, but I'm just going to throw this word out. Kind of wild. Kind of wild. So your birth name was Robert Campbell?
Robert Brian Campbell.
Robert yeah. Brian Campbell. Okay. Yeah, yeah. So how did you become Sensei Robert Chodo Campbell?
While you were talking to Koshin, or while Koshin was talking... Being an eight-year-old, looking at this picture of National Geographic, my mind went to me being an eight-year-old, taking care of my 25-year-old mother, who was a single parent and an alcoholic. And so taking care of her would be bathing her black eyes or making sure there was food on the table when the whichever stepfather we happened to be living with at that time. For a few months.
And this is where?
In Birmingham, England. Mm-hmm. And it was a series of geographics. You know, we would be living with someone for 3 or 4 months, and then the usual fights would ensue, and then we'd be off to other far distant places like Manchester or Halifax or Scotland until either mom got fed up of the boyfriend or the boyfriend got fed up of mom and this kid in tow. You know, this like 8-year-old kid. So I was passed out between mom and her sister and her great aunt. You know, my mom, who was on many levels actually an incredible caregiver in her later years. She worked for a number of years with, in those days they were called mental institutions with Down syndrome adults, and then she took care of seniors. So it was in the genes, but and so was alcoholism. You know, she we were both cursed with the Irish curse. And Mom would disappear. She would take me to her sister's house, my aunt, and say, "All right, Doreen, I'm off to work. I'll see you tonight." And then maybe 6 weeks later, she'd come back. And so my aunt had 10 kids. And so it was growing up in that environment. There were two really polar opposite environments. There was the one that was filled with uncertainty of my mother. Was she ever going to come back, or when was she going to come back? And what condition would she be in? And then there was the environment growing up with my aunt, who had eventually 10 kids, that she stayed home. She was knitting. She was making clothes. She was cooking. Her husband didn't drink. He was fairly abusive in other ways, but, you know, he didn't drink. And there was always someone home, and there was always food on the table, and I wasn't cooking it. and then when I was 12, my mom had another kid, my younger brother. And I remember the day she came home from the hospital, and the baby was crying. And she said, I can't shut him up. I don't know what's wrong with him. And I said, well, you have to change his nappy, his diaper. And she said, I don't know how to do that.
Whoa. What had she done with you when you were a baby?
She hadn't. There was always an aunt or her sister, or she was kind of like, eh.
Uh-huh. Handing
yeah. So I showed her how to change the diaper, and I showed her how to make the formula. They'd, in the hospital, she had, you know, they'd made the formula for her, and so when she came home with it, you know, in the hospital in those days, when you came home with a baby, they gave you a packet of diapers and a tin of formula and little instructions, and so I had to go through all that with my mom and show her how to dip your elbow in the water, make sure the bath water is not too hot, show her how to bathe my little brother. And that put me immediately into the new position of not only a caretaker for her, but babysitter, living babysitter. So that was pretty intense. And then 2 years later, she had another baby. And she was good at having babies, but she wasn't very good at keeping men or getting married.
So. Or apparently maybe taking care of the babies, yes, yeah.
You know, as she got older, I guess by the time she was 30, 32, she was becoming a little more responsible, basically because my aunts said, you've got to take some responsibility in your life. So she eventually settled down with one man. And it wasn't easy, you know, because now she had me, and the one man that she settled down with was the father of my two brothers.
I see.
And I was the interloper. So it was a very difficult transition from a 13-year-old to a 16-year-old after one of many fights with him. It was a really violent encounter one evening, and one of us would have ended up dead. And I put down the weapon and walked away and never went back.
What weapon?
It was a broken bottle from the doorstep.
So you ran away from home?
Yeah.
At 16?
Yeah.
And you mentioned the alcoholism. Was there alcohol involved in that fight and in your life generally at age 16?
Sure. My mother, of course, you know, she had a predilection for stocky boxer type men that were heavy drinkers, and he certainly was one of those, and she was too, but yeah. She could hold her own in a fight.
You're a stocky boxer type dude yourself.
Yeah, I got into a lot of fights
yeah.
As a youngster.
I wouldn't want to fight you now, yeah. Just for the record.
So yeah, I left home at 16 and embarked on a career of disco dancing, drugs, amphetamines, cocaine, and alcohol, working in bars, and just a series of geographics, as I mentioned earlier. I ended up in Spain as a DJ. I ended up living in Amsterdam for a year. Israel for a year.
Israel?
Yeah. I hitchhiked from London to Greece, from Greece to Turkey, from Turkey to Amsterdam. And it was all about, you know, of course, in hindsight, I realized it was all about just running. And I remember the reason I thought I would go to Israel and live on a kibbutz. I'd heard about this kibbutz. I thought, well, if I go to, I was 23, and I'd already started having a bleeding stomach, throwing up each morning. And
from what?
I went to my doctor, and he said, you know, you are in really serious health condition. You have a really serious health condition. You're drinking too much, which is causing this bleeding. You have a bleeding ulcer, basically. And you need to quit. And I was 23. And so I thought, you know, me being the smart person that I am, I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll go and live on a kibbutz where there's no alcohol. So I got on a plane, ended up in Tel Aviv. When I got to Tel Aviv, they said, where would you like to go? I said, I'd like to be as far away from basically any cities as I can get. And they said, we have just the place for you. And it was a little kibbutz all the way down south in Eilat, which is about 5 miles out of Eilat. And at that time, there was one hotel or two hotels on this kibbutz. And, of course, there were two hotels and one bar in Eilat. So after being on the kibbutz for about 6 months and making a little trip into Eilat every day to Henry's Bar.
Oh, so you kept drinking?
Kept drinking.
Yeah.
And then, I kept drinking. And then I left the kibbutz and started working in a hotel in Eilat as a chambermaid. That was all, the only job I could get was cleaning rooms and getting into trouble in cleaning rooms, stealing booze, and, yeah.
How did you go from this extremely reckless lifestyle to where you are now?
Mm. I came back to England after spending a year in Israel, and at some point during my teens, when I was 19, I got engaged to a lady with whom we had a relationship that was very much like the relationship between my mother and her boyfriends. It was a lot of drinking. It was like the karmic wheel, you know. It was just, this is how I was brought up. This is what relationships look like. This is how I should be in relationship. So it was a lot of drinking, a lot of really good times, and a lot of really bad times. Anyway, that relationship didn't last much longer than a couple of years, I think. But when I came back from Israel, I got in touch, and she said, well, why don't you come and live with me in London until you sort yourself out? And so that's what I did. And the craziness continued. But I met this really, really interesting man who was Jewish, and he had a printing company that worked predominantly with fashion models and photographers. And he was looking for a front man because he was kind of not the kind of person you'd want sitting in your office for many reasons. And he was looking for a front man to meet clients and get new clients and meet the models and meet the agents and the whole thing to get the business. And he loved the fact that I had been this kind of wild guy and lived in Israel. And he said, would you like the job? I said, sure, I'll give it a shot. I mean, I knew nothing about graphic design or fashion. Although being a disco dancer, I knew quite a bit about bell buttons and platform shoes.
right.
So I fell into this job like a duck to water. It was amazing. It was fashion. It was glamour. It was more drugs, more alcohol. It was a really great, great time in London. I bought an apartment. I was driving around in this fancy car. And after about 5 years, I got the itch. It was too much like settling down. And so I said to my boss, I want to leave. I need to do something else. And he said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, I think I'd like to go to the States, maybe New York or Los Angeles. And he said, well, why don't you go to New York, open an office for us there, and I'll pay all your expenses and go figure it out, which is what I did. I came to New York. And for 3 years, was on this roller coaster. I mean, coming to New York for me was like a kid in a candy shop. There were all the clubs. This was 1983, so it's 1983 in New York. The club scene, the disco scene, the drug scene. And for 3 years, I really took that on 100%. Then one morning after a series of really crazy, you know, what I was doing was pushing the envelope more and more and more. How dangerous could I really make this life of mine be? You know, I had witnessed two murders before 25.
In New York?
In England.
In England.
In England. And my mother at one point stabbed my stepfather. I mean, so violence was not new to me. And it was, so there was always, I needed the edge. I needed more and more and more and more. So I always, not always, I started putting myself in really violent situations or crazy situations here in New York. And at the very end of my drinking days, I actually was at a client dinner, fundraising party, and I think it was Regine's. And I was behaving really inappropriately with the money person. And so I was taken out of the club, put in a limousine, sent home. And I actually woke up in the gutter of where I was living at the time on Bleecker and Houston Street. And there was this very, very clear moment. It was, I think, the second act of divine intervention, if a Buddhist believes in God. I mean, the first act of divine intervention was when I put that broken bottle down. This, I thought, would be the second one, was when this voice very clearly said, the gig is up. You've got to stop. I was in therapy, luckily, for about a year at that time, and my therapist gave me the number of a friend of hers who was in Alcoholics Anonymous, AA, and said, here's her number, get to a meeting, and if you don't get to a meeting, our relationship is ended.
I'm dropping you as a patient.
Yeah. And I went to a meeting that night, and that was 28 years ago. So I've been clean and sober for 28 years. 5 years into my sobriety, I had sold my flat in London. I finished this career in fashion and glamour. I moved out to Sag Harbor, rented a house for a year, and during which time I found out I was HIV positive. And so that was really the reason for selling my house. I figured, well, at that time they said, you know, you have 24 months to live.
Whoa.
Because I wouldn't take AZT. I wouldn't do the drugs that they were giving everyone at the time. I just saw so many friends of mine dying, and they were all doing this drug AZT, and I said, I'm not doing that. Maybe that was the third divine intervention. Hmm. And my doctor said, well, if you don't start this regime, you'll be dead in 24 months. And I said, well, you know what? I don't think that's true. There was a piece of me that said, I've come so far, I'm not going to get, that's not going to take me out. And so I sold my apartment. I thought, well, if it is true, I'm going to go live in Sag Harbor, then I'll travel to L.A. and yada, 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 do some more geographics. And I ended up living in Sag Harbor. It was a beautiful, beautiful time for me for 6 years. And whilst I was living in Sag Harbor, I started training at a psychoanalytic institute. I thought maybe what I need to do is really look at the only thing I could really do now 5 years sober, the only thing that I thought that I would really be interested in was taking care of other people, taking care of other maybe addicts or adults from abusive homes, children. And none of this was really very clear. It was just all in the back of my mind. So basically, I was reliving my own experience. And every week, leaving my supervisor at the institute, I would see this woman come walking towards us. And she was this little lady, no hair, bright blue eyes. And I said to my supervisor one day, "Who's that lady that we see every week when I'm leaving?" And she said, "Well, why do you ask?" I said, "I'm just entranced by her. There's something about her that I really, I don't know, connect to on some level." And she said, "Well, why don't you introduce yourself to her?" And I said, "I feel really awkward. You know, she has cancer and she's kind of old." And my supervisor said, "Well, why do you think she has cancer?" I said, "Well, she's bald." And she said, "That's because she's a Buddhist monk." So the next week I saw her and I introduced myself to her. I said, "Hello, Leia said I should introduce myself to you. My name's Robert, and I don't know why I wanted to talk to you, but, you know, basically I'm an alcoholic, and I come from this really abusive childhood, and I was incested, and my mother this, and her boyfriend's this, and then this violence and that violence, and this drug abuse and that drug abuse, and now I'm clean and sober, and I don't believe in God, and I don't know where to go, and, you know, and I'm in this relationship, and I hate it, and my dream has come true, and we have a pool, and dogs, and cars, and this beautiful home, and I just don't hate, I mean, I don't know what I'm doing with my life." And she said, "Robert, do you know what you need to do?" And I said, "No." And she said, "You need to shut up." I was like, "Excuse me?" She said, "You need to shut up and listen to these stories that you're living in. That's all in the past. Where are you in this moment?" And I said, "I'm talking to you right now." She said, "Exactly. This moment is what's important. Yes, all the rest informed your life. All the rest got you here today talking to me. But you've got to let it go." And I said, "I don't know how to do that. I've been in therapy, I've been in therapy for 20 years, yada, 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 yada." And she said, "Why don't you try meditating? Come to the Zendo and I'll show you how to do that."
Zendo is the Zen center.
Yeah. Yeah.
And how did it go when you started meditating?
The first time I sat on the cushion, it was again, it was like my first AA meeting. So I thought, "I'm home. Wow, this feels right." But my mind was so crazy. I thought I would crawl out of my skin because she said, "Sit on that cushion and don't move for 30 minutes. Now, I was an amphetamine addict until I was 22. Sitting still? No. Running around London and nightclubs and running around New York? Sitting still? No. And I thought I would actually die from sitting still and listening to my mind. And over time, my mind started to quiet down. It's still crazy, but it's quieter. And I moved back into the city, into New York. And I'd been sitting now for about 2 years, practicing meditation. And I realized that I needed to do something else than just sitting on the cushion. I wanted to be of service, and that's when I started volunteering in hospice. And that's when I met Mimi and Koshin and helped take care of her. Yeah.
Full circle.
Full circle.
Well done.
It was great.
As they say at Amica, empathy is our best policy. Whether you need auto, home, or life insurance, they're ready to help you protect the things that matter most to you. They're a mutual company, customer-owned, in service to you. Amica representatives are here when you need them, and you can take comfort knowing a real person will be there on the phone to take care of you, because the greatest measure of their success is your satisfaction. You can count on T-Mobile to help keep you connected. After investing billions to light up their network from big cities to small towns, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, when you switch to T-Mobile, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus Verizon and AT&T. Visit your neighborhood store or T-Mobile.com to switch. Plan savings with T-Mobile. Third line free on essentials via monthly bill credits versus comparable available plans. Plan features may vary. Credits stop if you cancel or change plans.
So then you, on Mimi's insistence, you started the Zen Center for the New York Zen Center for Contemplative Care. Just give me a brief sense of what it is you do.
Mm-hmm. So the Zen Center does three main things. It's all actually basically about living an engaged life. And we do that through our study programs, through our direct care programs, and meditation training.
So you teach people how to meditate. You do courses in Zen subjects generally, and then you teach people how to practice hospice care.
Yeah, and what we also teach, we teach in two medical centers. So we're in the faculty of two medical schools, teaching doctors about how to incorporate meditation practice and ethics into how they are with their patients. And then we also have these national training programs where we're teaching anybody who would like to integrate a meditation practice and how they care in their relationships. That's a 9-month training that we do. And then we do direct care. We have really an incredible team of people who go to people's bedsides, and both here in the New York metro area, and we've trained people now in 32 states. So we have a network. So oftentimes people will call us and say, do you know someone in Atlanta? And we do. And we have people available to care for people.
And you're not only training people in how to be at the bedside, but you're actually doing this work yourself.
Absolutely.
So we've discussed me signing up and taking, it's a 9-month a course in learning how to be at the bedside, which is, you know, counter to all of my instincts as a monumentally selfish person who happens to be married to a monumentally compassionate woman who is at the bedside as a physician, and I'm sort of intrigued by what she does, and have yet, because I'm squeamish, never gone to work with her. But I am seriously considering taking your course in doing this work. So tell me, what would I be getting myself into?
Yourself. Really? You would be getting yourself into... Dan would be getting himself into Dan. You know, we have so many people that take the course. Usually we take about 35 students a year. And probably maybe 70% of those students, for varying number of reasons, do not go on to continue in hospice or hospital. They say things like, I never want to set foot in another hospital again until it's my turn.
Wow, that's a pretty high attrition rate.
Well, they go on to they go on in their own lives completely transformed.
Why don't they want to sit in a hospice again?
Because it's... maybe that piece of it doesn't fit into their life.
Yeah. Or is it just so hard?
It could be that it's difficult, but no one has ever not completed the course. Gone back. I mean, this is the important piece. We're looking at, how do you face your fears around death and dying? How do you face the fears of walking into a hospital room and seeing a patient that maybe has just is coming through an amputation or is hooked up to a machine in the ICU? How do you sit with that?
How do you sit with it?
Well, Koshin's going to tell you because he's like nudging me.
Let me just stop for a second, because I'm not trying to stop the fighting between the two of you. That I want to continue, but because you guys are smiling and laughing, here we are talking about death. You guys are marinating in this subject 24/7, and I don't know if people will get this through watching or listening to you. There's a real lightness to both of you, and you have a real sense of humor. I had lunch with you guys recently, and we were laughing the whole time. Why is that? And do you think there's a causal relationship in that?
Yes.
Okay.
Definitely.
Why?
Well, to me, the great fear, the greatest fear that I think all of us have, are meeting the realities of that our aging, our illness, and death. And
which is why he married an older man, so he could face his fears of aging.
He's giving you a look of, it's my turn to talk now.
Yeah. There we go. Taking a moment to enjoy silence.
for those listening to this, the facial interplay here is priceless. But anyway, carry on, Kojin.
But I think for me, actually sitting with people and actually realizing that this is it, and realizing that every day we're moving closer to our death, and to me is actually the great news. And many people say, oh, you know, I can't believe, you know, it's so depressing that you guys spend all your time with dying people. Do you spend most of your time with dying people, they say? And I say, well, we spend some of our time with people who know that they're dying, and the rest of the time we're spending time with people who don't know that they're dying.
Mm-hmm.
The reality of it, to me, makes life so vivid and beautiful. I mean, there was a reason why there, you know, these teachings for 2,600 years have been around, because it was actually about meeting, like sitting with a dead body. That
yeah. In the Buddhist time, they would meditate in the charnel grounds. They would sit and watch a decomposing body.
Exactly. So the reality of it. Now we say like, oh, let's, you know, put on some headphones and, you know, imagine that. But actually, the reality of being with dying people and sick people is so extraordinary, because there's something that strips away that the veneer that we put on it in society, as you talked about in the beginning, about how we like put the old people in the nursing home, we put the sick people in the hospital, we put the dying people in the hospice. But learning how to enter those spaces and with an intimacy, and to realize I am also that, I'm also you, the person in the bed.
Chodo's raising his hand.
Yes.
This is one of the secrets of our relationship. When we have conflict, it's rock, paper, scissors.
Mm-hmm.
Or raising our hands.
Or raising our hands if you want to interrupt. Koshin mentioned something that was really important for once. the intimacy. The piece that's, you know, missing, taking when we're putting our aging in nursing homes, where our sick are in, our people who are dying are in intensive care units hooked up to machines, to ventilators, people who are suffering, you know, they're in the hospitals. And when they're dying, they actually end up in hospice. 50 years ago, this wasn't the case. People were dying at home. We knew how to take care of people who were dying. We knew how to take care of grandma. We knew what to do. We knew that this was the end of her life. In England, here in the States, we have something called a DNR, Do Not Resuscitate. Mm-hmm. In England, they have something called an AND, which is allow a natural death.
Mm.
We were doing that 50 years ago all across the Western world, allowing for grandma or whomever it was that was dying of cancer or whatever it was to simply be home, and we would take care of them. But because we've changed in some, many ways in terrific areas, technology, women not having to stay home and be housewives and, you know, the little Betty at home cooking for husband when he comes home, everybody out at work having to earn a living, there's no one to take care of grandma if she gets sick. So it's like, what do we do now? And so it's really such a mark on society, how far we've come and how far back we've fallen in this area of caregiving.
And, you know, that's what's so amazing about, you know, this, the center and this training also is about that. The first year we thought like maybe it would be a few people who would be interested in the training. We thought that it would be really great to have like five people who would want to do this training. And we had like 75 applications the first year.
Yeah.
And, you know, people from all over the country, right, come in once a month to train with us. And each year it's so invigorating to see that people are turning towards what is scary, turning towards our fears. And because in some ways you're asking like, what are you going to experience? Well, you experience like all the different things that stop you from being in relationship, where you turn away, where you, you know, favor your distractions as opposed to
pull out your iPhone.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
But so tell me more though about what it does for you guys. I'm asking obviously from a very selfish standpoint. I would imagine you used the term before, stripping away. When you when you confront the fact that we are in this, these fragile bodies and that are made up of, you know, bones and flesh and skin and you know, thunderously obvious things that we just don't pay attention to, when you confront that in the way that you do, does it sort of sand the edges off of our perennial egocentric fixations and looping, fizzing stories we're telling ourselves all the time? Is that what it does for you?
Well, from,
Robert's raising, Chodo's raising his hand.
But if nobody calls on him, he'll just have to stay there.
Okay, yeah. Good luck with that, Koshin. Go ahead.
Yes. So anyway, to not look at this thing called death and dying is a deprivation, right? Mm-hmm. Because we're not living fully. We're not fully engaged in our life if we're not looking at the fact that ultimately this life as we know it is going to end. So when we're sitting with patients who are in the hospital with getting a hip replacement, we're facing sickness, aging. When we're sitting in hospice or in someone's home with a person that is dying, it's right there, right in there in front of you. And how can you not look at the fact, the reality that this life of ours is short? This life is not infinite. You know, we're going to, at some point, this is going to be me in that bed. So do I want to spend the rest of my life fearing that or embracing the life that I have? And that might mean having a lot of fun. That might mean
not missing an opportunity to actually love and to appreciate. So to me, it's all like what Chad was saying is so important because I feel that.
All right, so you're glad he raised his hand.
Oh, it's so important. Yeah. But I think that
most of what I say is very important.
Taking a breath and enjoying.
We're not like this at the bedside, by the way.
I hope you are like this at the bedside. If you're at my bedside, be like this. I think this would be.
But I think for me, it's really about how do you want to live your life? How do you want to live this day? And to me, it brings this kind of awareness, brings the day into kind of technicolor, you could say, right? It's just about, wow, I'm going to be leaving this room right now in a certain time. So how do I want to be in here? And how do I want to experiment with being more available? And because the reality is we assume that our life will go on a long time. But we know, in my experience in working in an emergency room, is that it's a learning that you never know that. That all kinds of things happen.
You know, my meditation teacher, Joseph Goldstein, likes to say anything can happen at any time.
Mm-hmm. And it does. And it's not an idea. You know, like to me it was exactly. And when I was working in an emergency room, I realized like, oh, that's actually true.
Mm-hmm. So are you guys no longer afraid of death?
What do you mean by
Are you no longer afraid of death after all this work that you've done?
I don't find death scary, but I don't know what it'll be like when I'm dying. When I'm actively dying, I don't know what that'll be like. Maybe I'll be very at peace with it. Maybe I won't. Because one of the things that I've also learned is, and when you spend time with dying people, is that people do it all very differently. Some people are like fighting it to the very end. And like that one person that we were with, and you know, they right before they died, they stood up and were like, no! And then they died.
Wow.
You know, and other people use it to really contemplate what their life has been. And other people, you know, just fade away. So to me, it's about being open to what that moment will be. I have no idea. But the idea of it is not scary to me. I'm actually quite curious and quite like I am about this moment. It doesn't feel different to me than this moment with you.
So being with me is a little bit like dying?
Yeah.
I've heard that many times, but you're the first person who's saying it in a non-judgmental way.
You just killed this interview.
No, but you know what I'm saying.
No, I do know what you're saying. Yeah. Absolutely. But have you found that I'm giving you permission to speak, Chodo, without Koshin's permission? I am giving you permission. Have you found that your fear of death, the fear of death that we all, I think, have, has it gone down for you doing this work?
No. I do. I'm concerned about certain aspects of the dying process.
Pain.
Not so much the pain. Pain can be managed, but the process that the helplessness that can come with a lingering death. So someone taking care of my bodily functions, taking me to the bathroom, changing diapers, feeding me. That's not what I want. So I'm afraid of that. Afraid of anyone just touching me. Is for probably historical reasons, that's not what I want.
You may not have a choice.
That's a much deeper question. I think I will have a choice.
Really? How?
Do we want to get into this conversation?
Yeah.
I would much rather go down the avenue of assisted dying. Than to, first of all, to prolong the inevitable for a number of reasons. First of all, the personal reasons of finding the idea of being in diapers and being taken care of, finding that absolutely abhorrent to me.
Why do you find that so?
It's something I haven't come to terms with. I took care of a friend who was for the last 5 years of his life, and the first time, he was my sponsor actually, so I'd known him for 25 years. And we knew pretty much everything about each other. And so in the last year of his life, when it was, you know, he was on 24/7 care, there was a day when his aide had to, I sent her off for lunch, you know. And I changed his diaper, and it was really, really difficult for me. The smell, the function of it, actually doing it, I managed to do it because I loved him so much. And when I had finished, when I cleaned him up, you know, showered him off and the whole thing, he said, you know, darling, thank you for doing that. And I said, not a problem. You know, I love you so much. And he said, no, that was really awful for you. And thank you. The thought of having Koshin being responsible for taking care of me in that way, or finding 24/7 care in a system where we don't have the money to do that. You know, so there are a number of reasons why I don't want my death to be prolonged.
What's the Buddhist view on assisted suicide?
It's not that. It's not my view. To take a life is not correct view.
So this is a heretical position you're taking?
Yes. But then I'm a kind of heretical kind of Buddhist.
Yeah. Yeah. I get that.
Yeah.
What do you think of
he knows question? I'll take care of him.
But what do you think of Chodo's position here?
Well, first of all, it's not legal in New York. Mm-hmm. And
yet.
Right. At this moment. And I think it's also a lot of, I understand the fear of it. I understand the fear of lack of control. And it's incredible. I mean, it's like the most vulnerable it will ever be. It's like kind of, we come into the world, you know, as a baby, where we require total care.
Mm. I mean, I have one at home, and yeah. I'm becoming familiar with it.
Mm. And then, actually, to me, the life cycle is then we go into a stage, we go back to that stage where we need total care. Mm-hmm. And to me, it's quite fascinating, you know, and I don't know what it'll be like. I'm sure it'll be like a lot of things. But for him, I think that's, you know, that total care is not something that he's really experienced before.
Right.
And so he didn't really have that. So it's, And I had that. And so I would imagine it would be scary. Mm-hmm. And kind of like, no, because it's just completely unknown.
It's alien. You know, right. I mean, me coming into the world as a baby was not one that was nurtured and swaddled and, you know, loved unconditionally. It was this inconvenience for this 17-year-old girl. And it's like, what am I supposed to do with this thing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you, in your work now, you see people who are in total care in hospice. Mm-hmm. And yet you wouldn't be able to relax into it and trust it, even though it's your environment. Mm-hmm. Pretty much daily now.
When I'm taking care of someone else, I am so totally 100% with that person. And it's as though, well, it's not as though, my hysterical history or whatever it is, my life experience is, although it's informed who I am and how I take care of people, it's outside the door. I'm there 100% with you. And this is what needs to be taken care of step by step by step. And if you vomit and if you, you know, piss yourself, whatever it is, I'm going to take care of that for you. But for me, I don't need anybody doing that. I don't want that. It's such anathema to me for someone to take care of me, because I've always taken care of myself until I met this one. Mm-hmm. And even in our relationship, it's very difficult to accept him taking care of me. You know, if I get sick, if I get bronchitis, which happens once a year, it's like, leave me alone. You know, I'll get through this.
Not a great patient.
I've gotten through so much worse, I can get through this.
So if or when I sign up for this, am I going to be having to change grown-up diapers and things like that? Or what is my role?
No.
Okay,
no.
So, but it's more about just being there at the bedside, yeah. Being willing to chat with people.
Yeah. I mean,
sorry, go ahead.
No, and I think it's... You know, as Toto was talking about, that not everyone will want to continue to do that, but I think what you will learn how to do is actually, as one person said, you've ruined me. Now I'm actually so curious about everything that's kind of going on. And so you're going to be learning how to walk into a room and actually taking in the whole room and taking in, but not the idea of the room, but like that particular room and also your internal state. And the state of the room and actually learning how to have a deeper relationship. It's kind of actually like to me, it's like engaged practice.
Well, that's what I was going to say. To me, it seems why I'm attracted to this is it takes the Buddhist practice way out of the theoretical, mm-hmm, and puts it right into the super practical, because I'm aware, as we discussed earlier, that the original Buddhists were doing things like looking at bodies decomposing. Mm-hmm. Why? Not because they were morbid or into the macabre, but because it was putting them in touch with what is going to happen to all of us,
mm-hmm, right?
Right? Your body, you're, mm-hmm, going to die, and your body's going to fall apart. Mm-hmm. And so people think it's not cool to say that in most circles in our society right now, but it's the truth nonetheless. And so me, that's what I'm interested in getting in touch with. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I can handle it, but I'm interested in trying.
One thing you will get in touch with beyond the course, beyond the hospitals, beyond wherever you would be placed, is your relationship to your own life and to your own family. You probably, I would say, we could place a bet on it right now that if you took the training, at the end of that training, you would be seeing your wife and your baby in a very, very different way. Mm. Because you would be seeing them through different eyes.
But what put some meat on the bone there. How would I be seeing them through different eyes? As impermanent beings?
Yes.
As impermanent beings and as... experiencing them moment by moment by moment in times. I mean, we can't live moment by moment by moment by experiencing like consciously, but to walk into the room, to walk into your home after a hard day's work, and this beautiful young son comes running towards you, Daddy, there might be a whole different experience of what that connection is like after you've spent a day in the hospital or a hospice with someone who's suffering. You know, even walking into Starbucks, the same Starbucks that you go into every morning, and seeing, you know, Gina behind the counter who has a name tag and you've probably never even noticed it. And just say, good morning, Gina, could I get a double espresso? And see her face. Wow.
Because I think in some ways the interpersonal relationship is like what's, you know, fading in this culture. And I think that how to actually be engaged in a sustained way in relationship and have intimacy with everyone that you kind of you're encountering is the potential and the possibility. You know, it just, they can't underestimate the power of it, about actually really learning how to sit with someone who actually knows that this is it, that they actually know that the days of their life are limited. And just sitting and going from room to room with people who know that their days of life are limited. Even if you allow that in for like one moment in 9 months, will change you.
Chodo has his hand up and he's just itching to talk. So, yes, sir.
The whole thing about how we are a sociable beings these days, you know, with our children, with
devices
and, when, you know, people on their cell phones and the iPads, you know, there seems to be less and less communication between adults with their children, children to their parents. I think I told you this story, Dan. One of our students who died recently, 2 years ago, actually, she was walking down the street one day, down Second Avenue, and there was a young woman with her baby in the stroller, and she was clearly distressed. She was crying, and she was messing with the stroller, looking through the blankets, and just really agitated. And Judith said to her, "Honey, what's wrong?" And she said, "I can't believe it. I've lost my damn cell phone." And Judith said, "Honey, I've just been diagnosed with terminal cancer. Look at this beautiful child in the stroller. Where are your priorities?" And this woman actually stopped and reached for Judith. And Judith said, "I don't need a hug. Your child does." And that was it. But the picture of this woman being so distressed by her cell phone and shuffling the blankets and moving the baby in case the cell phone had gone down the back of the stroller.
Jostling the baby.
And it's like craziness.
So it seems to me, and I want to set you free soon, but it seems to me that there's a kind of an interesting interplay for somebody in your position and my position as aspiring to kind of get into your position, is there's an interesting interplay here between service and self-interest, because you're serving other people, but it is also in your interest because it helps your practice. Mm-hmm. And it's like inextricably intertwined in some way. Mm-hmm. Okay, you're questioning that. Where am I off?
Well, I don't know if you're off, but it's not how I understand it. Because I think to me I understand it as the practice. So to me it's about how do we enter the practice more? And I think that it gets tricky when we think about it as my practice. Because to me about if I can become more awake and then I'm in the river of practice more and more available. I don't know if that makes sense.
No, it makes complete sense, but I feel like we're saying the same thing in different ways.
Okay.
Although I want to be clear that my capacity for misunderstanding and failure to comprehend and delusion is vast. But it seems to me that if you care about your practice, you want to be more awake, or to use your expression, to sort of be in the river of the practice in a more fulsome way. And if that means serving other people, then there we get to this intersection of your self-interest, for lack of a better term, and service.
Right.
I have a different view, of course.
That's surprising.
Surprisingly. Yeah. I mean, I think absolutely that, for me anyway, there's an element of self-interest, because for so many years, the interest was not on preserving this life of mine. It was about destroying it. Either drugs and alcohol or whatever else it was. So this life of service that I've entered into keeps me, I think, on many levels, keeps me sober, keeps me present to the fact that, you know, I'm really lucky. this is such an honor, such a privilege to take care of people in this way. And it fills me with such a sense of, on some level, such a sense of pride. You know, God forbid we should have pride. But, you know, we're not Catholics. I'm a Buddhist. I think I'm allowed a little bit of that. It is for me, on some level, self-serving, because it keeps me in the world in a safe way.
Yeah, maybe we could call it enlightened self-interest.
I would hate to use enlightened.
Yeah, well, that's a loaded term, to be sure. So before we close, I would be remiss if I didn't mention that you have a book coming out soon, Awake at the Bedside. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about it. And it's published by Wisdom Publications.
Yeah, so it's called Awake at the Bedside, Contemplative Teachings on Palliative End-of-Life Care. And it's a really, it's a book that our students have been asking for. And that's the doctors and nurses and just folks who are taking care of people. So it's a compendium of essays and poems by leading physicians and Buddhist teachers who are really reflecting on their own personal experience with death and dying and suffering. So it's, and they're, most of the essays are incredibly impersonal and really sharing both practices and when it goes well and when it doesn't go well. And I feel like it's an incredible companion for people who are themselves facing illness and those of us who take care of those who are facing these challenges.
I look forward to reading it. And this is just, if assuming I keep my promise and go through with the training, this is just the beginning of our relationship. And what I propose is that we reconvene in front of these microphones after I've gone through the training, and we can discuss it again. How does that sound?
How about at the beginning and the middle of your training?
I'm open to that as well. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Such a pleasure.
Thanks, as always, to the producers of the show, Lauren Efron, Josh Cohan, Sarah Amos, and Dan Silver. You can hit me on Twitter at Dan B. Harris anytime you like. If you liked the episode today and you want to hear more like it, you can subscribe to the podcast, rate it, and leave a review. Thank you for that, and we'll talk to you next week.
If you like 10% Happier, and I hope you do, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.
I'm Shimon Liai, and I have a new podcast called The Competition. Every year, 50 high school senior girls compete in a massive scholarship competition.
I wouldn't say I have an ego problem, but I'm extremely competitive.
All of the competitors are used to being the best and the brightest, and they're all vying for a huge cash prize.
This will probably be the most intense thing you've ever gone through in your life.
I remember that feeling because I was one of them. I lost. But now, I'm coming back as a judge, and also a kind of teen girl anthropologist. Because if you want to understand what it's like to be a young woman in America today, the competition's not a bad place to start.
Hopefully, no one will die on stage tonight.
From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery, this is The Competition. Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.